their group's rather mouthful, so we usually just abbreviate it to MRGSA, which also sounds a little dubious, but that's just so you know what that is. I want to thank everyone for turning out this afternoon. I know excitement has been building an expectation of this lecture. I know I was excited. In fact, when MRGSA realized we'd be able to help support Dr. Dyer's visit, we felt thrilled and honored that he would be our lecturer this year. For one thing, many of our members, at one time or another, have had his texts on their reading lists for their exams, on the bibliographies of their dissertations. His effect on this field cannot be underestimated. From his first monograph, Lords and Peasants in a Changing Society, to his most recent, A Country Merchant, Trading and Farming at the End of the Middle Ages, Dr. Dyer has established himself as one of the go-to experts in the field of medieval economics. A review of Lords and Peasants in a Changing Society, written by Edwin B. DeWint, and, you know, bear with me for a minute, I wanted the particular wording of this guy, noted that as a book for not only specialists in medieval rural history, but also generalists and early modernists, advising his audience to, quote, read it, study it closely, then read it again. The time will be well spent. Dr. Dyer has also called for an increased attention to individuals in addition to or instead of the grand narratives of history so often presented. As he says at the end of Making a Living in the Middle Ages, the accumulated actions of individuals created the new world with which the Middle Ages came to an end. Statements such as these, in some ways calling for a change in the direction of scholarship, explain why Dr. Dyer is such an influential figure. It is for this reason, his continued and meticulous attention to rigorous scholarship, enlightening both medieval and early modern studies, that Dr. Dyer is such an appropriate speaker for both the CMRS and MRGSA. An emeritus professor at University of Leicester and a senior research fellow at both the University of Birmingham and the Institute of Historical Research at the University of London, we are pleased to welcome Dr. Dyer here at OSU for his lecture, Diets of the Poor in Medieval England. I think we can safely say that our time will be well spent this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for that nice introduction, and thank you to everybody who's been involved in inviting me and entertaining me. We've really felt very, very welcome here, and this is our first time in Columbus, and it has been extremely enjoyable, and I hope I can, you know, with my talk at least repay some of the hospitality that you've provided. And I should say that the Centre for Medieval and Renaissance Studies here, you know, is well known in the world, and it's obviously an honour to be asked to talk to in its lecture programme. So many thanks for your invitation. I liked your comments about using my works in your graduate studies. I remember a student from Fordham, I think it was, who thanked me for writing my book on standards of living, because a question came up on his exam paper on standards of living, and because he'd read my book, he was able to answer the question. My immediate thought was the question wouldn't have been set if the book didn't exist, so I was really the author of his misfortune as well as helping him out. Right. Well, you see my title. I'm trying to tackle in my recent research a whole series of questions about poverty and the state of the poor in late medieval England. Who were the poor? How poor were they? How did they survive? How were they regarded and treated by the rest of society? This is the most difficult question, the one that interests me most. What was their own assessment of their position? I mean, can we hear a lot about the poor, but my ultimate aim is to try to understand the life of the poor as it was lived by themselves. These questions are not peculiar to medieval history, of course, because there's been a long-term interest in social welfare, if you like, covering a whole number of periods, of modern periods, as well as the Middle Ages. The questions, if you like, are much the same if you're studying poverty in the 1950s as they are in the later Middle Ages. But of course the answers are going to be different, and the answers are particularly difficult to devise in the case of the Middle Ages because of the nature of our sources. we can't go out and interview them, you know, about their experiences. I have chosen today as a way of approaching the problem a focus on diet as a theme for which there is quite a lot of evidence, particularly in the period after 1200. The information about food and drink gives us an insight into the way of life of the poor, their conception of themselves, and allows us to make comparisons with the rest of society. I'll here be critical of the view that saw and still sees the poor as the other, a race apart. Here's my first illustration. A race apart, an underclass whose way of life and outlook was alien to respectable mainstream society. This slide is of a painting by Bruegel, a painting of beggars, and it expresses a negative view held by many people at the time. The beggars are ugly, cunning, and are using fake disabilities in order to win sympathy. I mean, these people are not... Sorry, wrong. These people are not all of them lacking limbs. They've folded them back behind their legs in order to look as if they're limbless. The indication that they're fakes, that they're cunning, frauds, are these fox tails that are decorating their clothes. The fox tail is an indication of a cunning deceiver. Right, so, and it's a common belief among the critics of beggars, the people who disliked beggars, that they were frauds, that they used disability as a way of winning over the sympathy of people who would give them money. There's a German text of the early 16th century which lists 28 different separate fraudulent groups among beggars. You know, the ones who pretend they get epileptic fits, the ones who pretend they're on a pilgrimage to Rome, the ones who pretend to be blind, and so on. And so you have this this literature, if you like, about the deceptions practiced by beggars. And there's also a lot of alarmist writing about them, and a series of laws directed against begging or trying to limit begging, which begins in earnest in the 14th century. It was believed, for example, that beggars captured children, maimed them in order to win over the sympathy of almsgiving. They were demonized. They were equated with criminals. As to the diet of the poor, then you get these rather alarmist stories, particularly circulating in times of food shortage, of famine periods, when I suppose the least sensational idea is that they dig up roots in the forest and eat these unappetizing vegetables from the wild. That they eat horses. We all know that no one ate horses in the Middle Ages, so eating horses is a particularly disgusting thing to do. The odd hint of cannibalism. There's a wonderful chronicle reference to the poor, the hungry, eating pigeon droppings in the great famine of 1315 to 17. It's the most unappetizing as well as disgusting sort of food. It turns out that this is the result of a misunderstanding of a biblical reference. In the original Hebrew, pigeon droppings is a name for the beans of the carob tree, which are actually used for animal feed, and they're not entirely inedible. But I don't think anyone in early 14th century England ate carob beans, as they grew a very long way away in the Mediterranean. Of course, people at the time distinguished between different types of poor people. They wished to punish the idle vagrants, but they sympathised with people who we would describe as life cycle poor. That is, people like widows, sick, disabled, old, and so on. Many of whom would be householders, you know, who would be, you know, once respectable people who have hit on hard times. Their attitude to but they have a different attitude towards those who are subject to episodic poverty, that is, who are afflicted by the problems of bad harvests and food shortages. The problem there was that they felt a certain sympathy, of course, for people who were put into a difficult position by the rising cost of food and the shortages of food, but there was very little you could do in a severe famine, given the very large numbers of people who were suffering from hunger. The famines exposed a third type of poverty, if you like, structural poverty. That is, that there are in a society as it was in the early 14th century, around about 1300, where you have many small parcels of land, people trying to live on small holdings, where there isn't enough work, there's a widespread problem of underemployment and of low earnings. Those are the problems which are exposed when there is a poor harvest, because the people who are on low wages and so on are the ones who are most likely to be affected. I should say at the beginning also that there are obviously moral and religious values which are asserting the unity of society and set a high value on acts of mercy, such and particularly almsgiving. The soul of the donor benefited from the gifts made to beggars. This sometimes encouraged people to give charity without discrimination, you know, to spread it about, to throw pennies to a crowd as assembled at a funeral, for example. But the more thoughtful donors were in effect striking a bargain with the poor, that they selected people to receive alms and expected to gain prayers for their soul in exchange for their charitable giving. The idea of this bargain opens up the possibility of exploring the mindset of the poor themselves. They were not entirely powerless, if you like, they had a bargaining position, because people believed that a virtuous poor man was much more effective in prayers. Sorry, I'm being sexist. Women as well. Their prayers were effective in helping to release a soul from purgatory. And it was better to support a virtuous poor man than a fake or a fraud. Even Bruegel's beggars, the ones in the picture, are not just telling us about the distrust and suspicion of the rest of society, of potential donors. Beggars, as in this case, knew how to present themselves in order to, as they thought at least, to elicit the sympathy of those who might give them money or food. So there is, even in this hostile painting, a hint of the mindset of those who are hoping to receive charity. So far I've tried to distinguish between different types of poverty and different types of poor people. The scale of the problem is one that's very difficult for us to judge. How numerous were the poor? How large was the problem facing society as a whole? I think most people would agree that the problem was on a larger scale between, say, 1280 and 1348. The end of the 13th, early 14th century is a period when holdings of land are particularly small, wages are particularly low, and there are problems of bad harvests culminating in that great famine in 1315 to 17. That from about 1380, late 14th century, going forward into the early 16th century, there were fewer mouths had to be fed, the population was smaller, wages were higher, and the main basic food, bread, was relatively cheap. I tried to quantify the situation by guessing on the number of people who... guessing is perhaps the wrong word. Estimating, as best I can, how many people would be in danger of not having sufficient food to keep themselves alive. And the figure I come up with is near to a million in 1300, near to a million poor people in England in 1300, out of a population of between 5 and 6 million, and 120,000. In 1500, so a much smaller number by 1500, a much smaller a proportion of the population. The population is only just under 2.5 million, but the proportion is obviously much smaller. And it's interesting, of course, that people are much more talk much more about the beggar problem and the poverty problem in 1500 than they do in 1300. You know, there are legislation, there's all sorts of agitation in society as a whole about the problem of beggars and poverty. It reminds me of the situation in the UK now, which is probably the same here, that the levels of crime have actually been declining in the last 6 or 7 years. You know, there's all the statistical indicators are there's less crime in 2013 than there was in 2018. And yet everyone believes that crime is a serious problem and that they are likely to be a victim of crime. You know, it's a similar situation, a misperception, if you like, of the real situation. Right, let me now get through to the, I've had those introductory remarks, let's go through to the substance of my talk. First of all, I'm going to talk about the diets of those we do not usually categorise as poor, society as a whole, and then I will look at three sources of information which help us to reconstruct the food and drink, using as evidence doles, food served in hospitals and almshouses, and if I have time, I'll say something about the size of bread. If I don't have time, you can ask me about that in the question session. Right. Well, let's first of all say something about the diets available to people who were receiving adequate nutrition, shall we say. It's wrong to think that there's an unbridgeable gulf between the very rich, the aristocracy, and the sort of middling ranks of society, the better off peasants, the better off artisans, and so on. Because there is an essential similarity in the basic foodstuffs that they are consuming. Bread, ale, and a dish of meat or fish is, you know, if you like, the basic food served, you know, in a monastery or in a household, an aristocratic household, or in a peasant's house. For peasants, that is people cultivating small quantities of land, so we say 30 acres or less. We can see from the agreements made when an old peasant or an old peasant couple retired, we can see from the agreements made that an allowance of grain is made to provide them with the basis of life. And that's enough. 12 bushels of grain is enough to provide them an individual with about 2,000 calories per day, which seems to be enough to sustain life. And there's additional evidence that they're receiving other types of food. They're being allowed to keep poultry, they're being allowed to keep a pig, they have access to a garden. So the grain is not their only type of food available to them. These agreements between people taking on a holding of land to an old peasant retiring specify the types of grain they're going to receive, and you can see their regional differences. Wheat in the south and west of England, rye and barley in particular in the east, oats in the north and the far west. When you look at the meals that were given to wage earners, we're particularly well informed about the food that was dished out to harvest workers during that period through August and September when they're bringing in the harvest. One sees there the importance again of wheat in the southeast, barley in Norfolk. But the main thing we get from studying those diets are the changes, the way in which the diet improves over the period of the Black Death. Before 1348, these workers were eating bread, cheese, salt meat, bacon, and salt fish, and were sometimes given cider as well as small quantities of ale. And there's a big contrast with what is served after the Black Death, after 1348, in that the you see more fresh meat, fresh fish, less cheese, and gallons of ale. And the farm servants, not so much the harvest workers, but the farm servants regularly, were often being given vegetables as well as this issue of grain. And it's quite interesting also to see that there's a sort of way of serving food, a food culture, among those people who have adequate amounts of food, if you like, which shows that they're not just seizing food and stuffing it into their mouths without any discipline or ceremony. For example, the harvest workers will eat at a long table like the ones that you're sitting at, and there will be tablecloths, linen tablecloths, spread on those tables. In peasant households, you find evidence of ewers and basins, suggesting that they washed their hands before they ate, which doesn't quite fit in with the picture of peasant life you see, for example, in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you know, where they live in a permanent sort of state of covered with mud. If you're going to pick on one feature of the diets of these people earning wages and of peasant households, which distinguishes them from their rich aristocratic superiors, it is their consumption of pottage, you know, a constantly available, if you like, a mixture of boiled oats or barley together with vegetables, and if they can afford it, smaller quantities of meat. They're very much pottage eaters. Right, so that's my sketch of the diets of people above the ranks of the poor. And now I want to look at the diets of the poor and see how they compare with the standard that I've been talking about. We're going to look at doles, food handed out poor, mainly by institutions, but you also see monasteries and so on, but you also see them being handed out by secular households, even by individuals. There is the donor, a saintly donor, who is going to give a rather sort of beautifully dyed green gown to somebody, but above all he's handing out loaves of bread. And there are the poor. How different they are from the ones painted by Bruegel, aren't they? They are respectful, dignified, rather well dressed. I mean, they have good reason to be poor. This poor man at the bottom is obviously very severely disabled. This man here, I think, is a has a stick and is obviously having mobility problems. I think there's a pilgrim behind him, and so on. There are people who are, you know, in various categories of poverty, but it's essentially a sympathetic picture of people who deserve to be relieved from their hunger, and they are, as I say, a dignified group. Now, if you look at the records of dolls, of which there's very large quantities, you can, if you like, categorise them into the very large ceremonial handouts, where large quantities of loaves of bread, for example, will be handed out on a particular day. The one I picked out here is that at Worcester Cathedral on St. Wulfstan's Day, which is the 19th of January, a good time of year to be handing out free food, you know, when people are likely to be hungry. They handed out 70 monk's loaves. Those are large loaves made of wheat, 200 small loaves, which are actually made of rye, a cheaper grain, and 2,000 small loaves of pulse. Pulse is a mixture of peas and beans. So, you know, there are many more of the cheapest, nastiest loaves than there are of the best ones. But on the other hand, the size of the monk's loaves means, in fact, that about 40% of the grain that was being handed out was actually wheat. Now, more numerous and of greater value to poor people than that sort of large handout were the smaller dolls handed to by, for example, the rectors of parishes. At a parish called Bybury in Gloucestershire, for example, in the 15th century, they were handing out each week 2 bushels of wheat and 4 bushels of malt. Rather superior grain there, but obviously in much smaller quantities. The choice of the grain that was given out in alms in this way is quite a complicated choice to analyse. To some extent, they were handing out the grain that was available. Norwich Priory, living in an area where a lot of grain, a lot of barley was grown, hands out a lot of barley in its doles. But sometimes you find that, as in the Worcester case that I gave you, you find that the food that the poor normally expected to, were given, was what they were normally expected to eat. You know, that the rich people, if you like, were estimating what would satisfy the needs of people of low income. They might even have been thinking that these were the foods that they ought to consume, you know, as the rich often have very good ideas of how the poor should live. So it may be that these dolls are an indication to us, a rough indication to us, of the resemblance between the diets of the poor when they were at home, choosing how to spend their meagre resources, and what they get in the dole is a hint of the sort of food they would normally expect to consume. The very low status food, of course, is the peas and beans. I mean, an upper class household would feed bean bread to the horses. I mean, no rich person would ever eat such food. So that is an indication of how low down the scale the provision for the poor could be. And there's no doubt that these beans, peas and beans, were sometimes being issued not as an ingredient in pottage to be boiled up and eaten with vegetables and so on, but they're being sent out to be to be baked into bread. Because as in the Worcester case, a better case from Gloucester, the dole of peas and beans was to be made in the form of bread. But you can see that generally, then the poor expect to put a lower quality of grain. If they're not having peas and beans, they're expected to eat rye and maslin. That's a mixture of rye and wheat, or barley. And these are inferior to the grains eaten by most of the rest of society. You can see change, though. These doles, although they're very traditional, St. Wolfstan's Day dole is one of the great traditions of the cathedral, which goes on for centuries, you do actually see sometimes the allowances change. At Norwich Priory, for example, they dished out barley in the 13th and 14th century, and then changed over to rye. Rye is an inferior grain, but it's not as cheap and inferior as barley. We ought to distinguish, I suppose, between the large numbers of people who were receiving these great doles, like St. Wolfstan's Day one, where the people who were handing the loaves out would not know the people who were receiving. And for all they knew, frauds and fakes and people who didn't really need the bread were coming forward. There's a difference there between what's going on with the Bibury dole. I mean, Bibury is a very small parish, and the rector or his servant would know the people who were receiving the 2 bushels of wheat and the 4 bushels of malt. So there was an element of selection of individuals. And I can show that in the case of the parish of Rittle in Essex, where they gave out the wheat, it says in the accounts, to Andrew Hawkes, a beggar, and to Thomas Clark. So they actually name the recipients. These are individual people known to those who are making the grants. So I take it that if you knew the person involved, you were perhaps more likely to hand out a higher quality of food, because certainly the Bibury grant, for example, is providing people with the materials to make wheat bread and to brew ale. The same goes for those individuals who leave in their wills. These are wills mainly surviving from the 15th century. These people leave in their wills grants, particularly of wheat and malt, to be given to the poor of a particular parish. Again, sometimes they actually name the recipients, more often they leave other people to make the choice, but they say they've got to choose the most indigent, the most deserving, in other words. And you get the impression from that of a widespread consumption of wheat bread, a lot of provision for the poor to drink ale. They're getting malt, and the only thing you can do with malt is to brew ale from it, and they are also leaving herring and small amounts of meat as well, so that they are providing for a better standard. Individual will makers, therefore, thinking in terms of individual people who are receiving these things, will be providing them with a better class of food than will be handed out at a monastery gate to an anonymous crowd. I think that you can envisage the life of the poor person who were not receiving doles, who only received them occasionally. Remember, our evidence is telling us about what has been granted by well-documented institutions. And the problem we have is deciding what people are consuming out in the undocumented communities, in which very large numbers of widows, disabled people, old people, and so on, are trying to put together a living from a combination of devices and arrangements. Little bits of food that they can produce for themselves, earnings that they can make from spinning, for example, assistance that they can get from their own families or from their neighbours or from the local community. And it's the way of life of those people, the semi-independent households of the majority of poor people, the people who are not receiving doles, where we can get a hint of the standard they were expecting to live by looking at the foodstuffs that they that would be handed out in the monastic or institutional handouts. I want to turn now to look at households, at hospitals and almshouses. These again are dealing with a relatively small number of recipients. There are about 600 hospitals and almshouses existing at any one time. Many of them are not very well endowed. Many of them have a rather fragile existence. They survive for a few decades and then fold up and disappear. But anyway, there are about 600 at any one time. And many of them have only 12 inmates. And an estimate has been made that towards the end of the Middle Ages, there were about 7,000 paupers living in such accommodation in hospitals and almshouses. So it's a relatively small proportion of the total. Remember, I made an estimate of 120,000 as a whole, so this is a small fraction. But they are very well documented, and that we can use the regulations of these hospitals, the accounts in which food is valued and the quantity given is suggested. These are extremely valuable sources. This is one very well documented hospital of U Elm in Oxfordshire, founded in 1437 by the Delapole family, by the aristocratic Delapole family, who founded it as an almshouse, a chantry with priests saying prayers for the souls of the departed Delapole family, and for a school. And we have the statutes of that particular institution. There's a plan where you can see that it's arranged rather like a small Oxford college, with the quadrangle and the rooms for the poor people built around. So we know something of the way of life of that institution. And here's another one. That one is in the countryside. This is an urban one where most almshouses are to be found. This is at Sherborne in Dorset. Founded quite near in date, in fact, to U Elm in 1439. And again, it's for a dozen poor people, nominated by the townspeople. The hospital is administered by the town, and this was one of the central institutions of the town. Some of these hospitals and almshouses have provided really very generous diets indeed. There's a leper house in County Durham called Sherburn, where we have regulations which say that each leper should be provided with a £3 loaf of bread each day, a gallon of ale each day, a dish of meat on 3 days, and fish on 4 days. I mean, it really is like the diet you would find in an Oxford college. On the other hand, some others were very poorly endowed indeed, and at U Elm, they didn't hand out food, they gave out money, and there each pauper received tuppence per day, which would provide you with quite a decent meal. I mean, you could live on a penny a day in the 15th century, and so tuppence was really quite generous. But you find others where the amount allowed each day was a halfpenny or less, and obviously people had a very difficult time. They would have to supplement the small amount that they received from the almshouse authorities with the products of begging, with gifts from other charities. But I think that's what's interesting about analysing the diets provided in hospitals is the assumption that even in the poorer ones, unlike the one at Sherburne, is that people are going to get wheat bread, they're going to get ale, they're going to get a certain amount of meat and fish, and this is going to be inferior to what will be provided in a properly financed household, but nonetheless the assumption is that people are eating a diet not entirely dissimilar from that of the rest of society. There's a hospital of St Anthony's in London, for example, where by chance we have records of the food given to the master, the man in charge, the food given to the hall, where many priests were being fed, and the food that went to the paupers. And the master tended to get luxuries like chicken and conies, rabbits and larks. The hall were eating chicken and pork and goose, and on the same day when those foods were being served, the hospice, as it's called, the inhabitants of the almshouse, were getting mutton. And there's a certain monotony in their diet, whereas the other parts of the hospital get a variety of food. The paupers get mutton every day, and it must have become rather boring. So hospitals were peculiar institutions, in some way isolated from the real world, but I think in the diets that they provided, they were thinking that the paupers should receive a less expensive, a less luxurious diet than the rest of society, but nonetheless one which consisted of bread, often made of grains other than wheat, a certain amount of ale, often in smaller quantities than would be provided in a well-funded household. They tended to, hospital inmates tended to get large quantities of pottage. I always like this account of the Sherborne Dorset St John's Almshouse. Shows their special Christmas treat. You can see it for 1428-9, is that the big feature of their Christmas fare is very large quantities of oatmeal. So that means that they had lots of extra helpings of pottage. So that was their idea of a special treatment. So pottage is something the poor eat. But they do have a certain amount of bread. They have a certain amount of ale. More than the rest of the society, they will get dairy products, and they will get vegetables. And, the aristocratic household had a very low regard for vegetables and fruit. Raw fruit was regarded as a sort of penance, really. Whereas the paupers were often expected to eat vegetables. The Sherburne Durham lepers, for example, had quite a large garden, and they were expected to work in it and produce leeks and cabbages for their own meals. But I suppose the real break between regular society and the life of the poor, which is reflected in the life of some hospitals, is the uncertainty and irregularity of supply. There was never any question that an aristocratic household, or even the household of a richer peasant, would starve. But in times of bad harvest. But you find in the hospitals that the diet is reduced in bad years. Mm-hmm. There's an example from a hospital in Wiltshire, for example, where you can the regulations, in fact, allow for a reduction in the amount of bread that will be provided to the inmates when there is a bad harvest and the price of wheat goes up. And there were problems in a number of hospitals and almshouses as their landed endowment went down in the 14th and 15th centuries. They simply couldn't afford to keep up the standards to which they were used, and you get legal disputes and quite bitter complaints about the decline of the quality and quantity of food, which is an indication, of course, of what was going on through society as a whole when the price of wheat went, well, grain went up, and when supplies were short. So to draw just a preliminary conclusion from the hospitals and almshouses, I would say that it is possible for us to separate the diet of the poor that is described there between that of the those people who were adequately supplied with an adequate income, and they eat inferior grain. They have smaller quantities of ale. As I've said, they have a higher proportion of pottage, vegetables, and cheese, which seems to be an indication of a poorer diet in the later Middle Ages. But their food can be monotonous and uninteresting, and it can sometimes be unstable and variable. But I would emphasize that they are inhabiting the same world as their neighbors. They aspired to eat and drink in a similar style, and they shared some of that the assumptions of a basic diet of bread, ale, and the accompaniments. I'll just say something very briefly about the assize of bread, because it's a way of which we can look at the lives of people who are not dependent on handouts, either from rich institutions, from the hospital administration, or from the provision that people make in their wills. Because we have, in the case of a number of towns, evidence for a hierarchy of bread and the regulations that were enforced to try to prevent profiteering by bakers. The idea of the assize of bread was that if the price of wheat rose, the size of the loaf diminished. And bakers the bread was carefully examined and analysed to make sure that the weight was in accord with the law, and a baker who cheated by selling too light a loaf would face punishment. See, the loaves are standard prices. You can't the standard prices are a farthing, a halfpenny, and a penny per loaf, and the bakers therefore will be selling bread of various types at a farthing or a halfpenny, and the weight of the loaf that you get for that price varies with the price of wheat, with the quality of the harvest. And because there is such a hierarchy of bread, you get this wonderful array of this wonderful vocabulary for describing the various types, from the very most expensive and the whitest at the top. Everybody in the Middle Ages wanted white bread, and wastel was very often the whitest that you could get. That was the highest quality. As you see, you go down through whole wheat and to brown bread and treat, which is a brown bread, right down to bread containing grain other than wheat. Maslin, that's a mixture of wheat and rye, and right at the bottom, the bread you gave to horses. And the
regulation of the size of bread gives us an insight into the types of loaves that were being sold, because the bakers, in this case at a small town in Norfolk, were fined every time, they were punished every time that they sold a loaf that was too light. And the surprising thing that I found when I looked at these figures was the quite high proportion, a quarter of the loaves, which are wastels, the whitest, the most common, of course, two-thirds of them, is cocket bread, which is not the whitest, but it's still a bread of sort of middling quality. So the people of the bread that was being sold to the people of Hingham was very often a farthing loaf of cocket was by far the most common. And that suggests to me that the consumption of wheat in this town, of wheat bread, was in fact quite widespread. In other words, the people who were eating the real cheap and inferior grains, the people who were eating rye, maslin, and barley and so on, were probably living in the countryside, or they were baking their own bread or taking it to the common oven, and they were not buying it from bakers. So there's a sort of hierarchy of bread that is within the legal limits, and then there is this cheaper bread which does not come up in the legal enforcement of the assize, which is aimed to protect the consumer from exploitation by the bakers. So that's a little insight into the way in which people get their bread in a small town in Norfolk, and I could, the results that I've given you are much the same in the other communities which I've been able to investigate. Let me end by just summing up some of my main conclusions. The poor included outsiders, people who lived beyond the margins of society. I've done a study of the people who are described as poor in manorial court records. 4/5 of them were people with some stake in conventional society. In other words, it's only a small minority who one could fit with the Bruegel painting of the beggars beyond the pale of society. 4/5 of them then were people with holdings of land, a craft or trade, some sort of employment, who had encountered some misfortune or through some miscalculation found themselves without support. Donors were only too aware that they themselves might share the same fate, which motivated them to give alms as well as the need to save their souls. The poor themselves wished to live as much as possible like the rest of society. Some of them conformed to the stereotype of the shame-faced poor. Those are the shame-faced poor. Some of them conformed to the stereotype of the shame-faced poor, and they attended funerals and commemorations and added their prayers to those of the clergy in return for which they received a loaf of bread, a meal or a penny in hash. One likes to think that some of them regretted their misfortunes and blamed others. Contemporaries were suspicious that the poor were potentially subversive, spreading discord. A theologian feared that if they wished to improve their condition, they might fall into the sin of avarice. I began with a miserable story and an unpleasant image, but I end, I think, with that assessment of the poor's attitudes towards their own condition with a sense of hope. Thanks.
As we often often do in order to allow those who might have to rush off to another meeting. We'd like to have just a few minutes of questions and answers, burning questions, before those who can stay for a bit longer can join us as we get some tables together and have a cracker and have a more informal talk with Chris. Thank you very much. It was a wonderful talk. Any questions?
Other records of gleaning, presumably gleaners would be at the lower level of society.
Yes, indeed, yes, yes. Indeed, the rule was that you could only glean if you were in a category of, if you like, deserving poor, widows and people of that kind. The rule was, which comes in at the end of the 13th century, in fact, before the legislation about begging and attempts to tighten up on illicit arms collection and so on, from the late 13th century, they said, if you can earn a penny a day as a harvester, you're not allowed to glean. So in other words, it's only the people who are incapable of hard work who are allowed to pick up the grain. For those of you who don't know the term, it means picking up the ears of corn, the odd grains that have been left behind by the harvesters in the harvest field, and the gleaners are indeed the village poor.
So one of the things that struck me was about the, on one side, the discussion of inferior grains, but on the other side, a lot of those grains would be the ones that we would consider to be very nutrient dense.
Yes, yes.
And so, when it opposed to the societal status of the food that the poor was eating, can you say anything about the nutrients of the meals based in class?
You're expressing the problems that foodies have when they encounter medieval attitudes towards food. I mean, wheat was regarded as the superior corn. It was, it looked better, it was whiter, it made a better crumb, it gave a more aerated loaf, it was a nicer texture, it had a better flavour, it had, everything was going for it in terms of status. And the whiter the bread, the better. You know, the hierarchy of loaves that I showed earlier, you know, that one is really saying white is best. And that means the bread from flour where the maximum amount of bran has been taken away. The things which fill us with horror, of course, you know, the awful sort of in England we call them sliced loaves, you know, the sort of soggy white bread that are only eaten by the poor now. That's the interesting thing. They're only eaten by the poor now, which we wouldn't touch. Were the highest regarded, most highly regarded in the Middle Ages. And what you're saying is that surely there are compensations for the poor because rye bread and barley bread was good for you and the browner bread was good for you as well.
Well, no, I'm not suggesting that they had it better in that sense. I'm asking about the meals overall, because this bread is one part of a meal,
yes.
But the meals overall were poor people getting their nutrients fulfilled in a similar way as people that were wealthier, or were they truly lacking in nutritional fulfillment?
As far as we can see, everyone ate bread. The problem for the poor was that they didn't get enough. I mean, that was it's a quantity rather than a quality problem. Because in many ways, the diet of the poor was better. Remember I was saying that they ate fruit and vegetables more, particularly vegetables. The aristocracy are very suspicious of vegetables. Salads are bad for the digestion. You know? And the poor are picking leaves out of the woods and so on and eating. So, you know, in many ways the quality is better, but it's the crucial thing is the quantity of bread that they have. See, if the size of bread is enforced, the size of the
of the cheaper bread, whereas the treats, for example, the cheaper bread like treat, the size of the loaf diminishes substantially, because that's the way in which the baker allows for the higher price of wheat, and so the poor can only buy. After all, each loaf costs a farthing. So if they buy 4 farthing loaves, they're getting much less bread than they would in a good year. Someone over there.
Yeah, this is kind of a big picture question, but I looked at, what is your thought now on the question of late 13th, early 14th century, we'll set aside the famine, but generally the condition of English people as they face the Black Death. are they malnourished, and does that, I don't believe this, but I just want to know what your opinion is. My position is Black Death. I wonder what your thoughts are about the condition of these people as they face
the planet. Well, I don't think, I deliberately call my talk diets.
Yeah.
You know, there is great variety. I mean, that there is a section of, you know, village society, peasant society, who are not suffering from malnutrition and serious food shortage. The quality of their diet and their quantity of their diet is diminished in times of extreme famine, but generally speaking, they're getting enough to eat. And there's a substantial minority of people, shall we say, who are not malnourished and in a miserable state. But remember I gave you a figure of 1 million? I mean, that's something like 20% of the population are in serious trouble. And that number diminishes greatly after the Black Death. So, yes, there is a problem of malnourishment, there is a problem of hunger, there is a problem of starvation in bad years. But it's affecting a substantial minority of the lower end of society, particularly the people dependent on wages.
Well, what I was spinning off of was old Benedict Dow's analysis of Black Death. Yes, there's a difference, but it's not as much of a difference as you might expect in terms of the class differential.
The Black Death does seem to kill people who are nutritionally good quality. Yes, there's a wonderful piece of research recently they've done on the bones from the Smithfield Cemetery. And what they've done is to analyse the chemistry of the bones and the signs of hunger that you can see etched into the eye sockets of the skulls, for example. If you've been through a bad period of hunger, this will be visible in the bones. And they've tested it to see if these conditions were worse for the people who lived through the Great Famine, as distinct from those who did not. And they can't see any evidence. They don't see any evidence that the Great Famine caused great suffering to the population of London. So it's a conundrum. I mean, but as far as we can see, the Black Death did not selectively kill the poorest of society. There's someone over there.
Yeah, there's one. Sure.
Just out of curiosity, have you used archaeological evidence to look at diet of the poor?
Yes, I was sort of, I suppressed it in my talk, not because it's not important, but because it takes a bit of time to discuss. There is a lot of bone evidence of meats that were eaten. It's frustrating, of course, because you can't say how much meat people ate, but you can say what sorts of meat they ate.
Through, like, isotope analysis, is that what you're...
Well, this is much simpler than that. It is simply collecting together a great heap of bones, deciding what species they are, what age they were when they died, and so on. And from that, you can see, for example, you find very, on village sites, on rural sites, you find a lot of sheep bones. But if you work out how much meat there was on a bovine carcass, as distinct from a sheep carcass, you can show that they're actually eating more beef than mutton, So, you know, beef is their most important source of meat. But you don't know whether they're eating beef, you know, once a year or once a week. You know, the evidence is not capable of being quantified in that way. And to make an assessment of nutrition and so on, we would really like to know more about the quantities involved. But there's a lot of insights from archaeological evidence. For example, preserved grain. I mean, you get burnt wheat and burnt barley and so on. So you can actually, for example, you can show that, unknown to us from the documents, they were choosing particular varieties of wheat. There's something called rivet wheat, for example, which they're growing. And then it must be because there are advantages in terms of preserving the wheat from the ravages of birds, for example. And there are all sorts of ways in which the particular varieties of wheat will produce a better result. So the peasants and so on are choosing the grains, which the species of plant, which are most advantageous to them. But it doesn't impinge on the particular problems that I was talking about here. There's a lot of interest in that evidence, but it doesn't actually help us very much with that. I'll tell you one piece of archaeological evidence which does impinge on what I said, and which I should have included, which is one of the best pieces of evidence of that relentless diet of pottage, which you find in lower class households, is the presence of large numbers of cooking pots. You know, they're boiling things all the time, and I'm sure the main thing, well, they're boiling water to brew, but they're mainly brewing these wonderful pottages, which are obviously one of the staples of their diet. And they've actually analysed chemically the residues inside the pots and find, for example, traces of cabbage, you know, showing that there is this vegetable content in those pottages, which we know a little bit about from documentary sources, but very, very dramatically confirmed by that bit of organic chemistry.
I think we have time for one more question there in the back.
Speaking of archaeological evidence, I'm thinking of bioarchaeological, the bones again.
Yes.
Have you considered evidence on stature that would speak to the nutritional condition of the population?
Yes.
Especially the poor versus the rich.
The best evidence for the rural population comes from the big cemetery at Warren Percy in Yorkshire. The best evidence for the urban population, for the ordinary urban people, comes from St. Helens and the Wall on the Wall in York. And so one has these two. It's rather fortunate we've got the two big samples of bones from two cemeteries not very far apart. So it's the same sort of population. As far as stature is concerned, I ought to carry the figure in my head, shouldn't I? And I think I don't think I do. The height of the men are higher than women, as you'd expect. Their height is greater than that of the urban working class in the 19th century, but it's less than it was, say, in Anglo-Saxon England in, say, the 7th century, that those people seem to be bigger. So there's evidence there of some sort of perhaps nutritional decline during the Middle Ages, but it's not a decline to such a low level as you would find among the working class population of the great cities after the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. Someone mentioned isotope analysis. Of course, from the chemistry of the bones, you can work out whether they eat meat or fish, for example. And there's good evidence of fish eating, even from populations living quite a way inland. So sea fish is quite an important part of the diet of what the Warren Percy peasants, for example, which is slightly surprising. Though there are some fish bones have been found in the excavation of the houses, so it's not a complete shock. And there's also evidence of, for example, breastfeeding. You can show that infants were breastfed for the first 2 years. And the person who analysed this thought that babies had rather a good start in life because of that. But then things went downhill after that, and you know, the younger children are getting a rather poor diet
mainly a vegetarian diet, and of course there are some very high rates of child mortality. But those are the sorts of insights you can get from the study of human donors. You can even detect obesity, of course, from a condition called DISH. From the study of the bones, you can see that people are overweight. You'll be amazed to find that not many peasants were overweight. but if you dig a monastery, you get a different story.
Please, those of you who can stay, please join us for some refreshments and a little bit more of a casual conversation.
Which table
thing?
I imagine.